Okay, so let's talk about this next parami of panya, penetrating insight, sometimes translated as wisdom, not the best translation. Penetrating insight, this is what our path actually is really partially all about, isn't it? Many of you practice insight meditation. This is really what we're concerned with, what we're dedicated to. So what do we understand about panya? What do we understand about insight? What does it look like? Now, clearly, insight is the antidote to delusion, isn't it? It's the antidote to confusion. It's the antidote to wrong view. So insight is relational. It's not about having some particular experience on a cushion. It is an antidote to confusion, delusion, and wrong view. So how is this talked about, certainly in the Buddhist teaching? Well, part of insight, and if I just list some of the insights that I mentioned, it is the clear, unarguable discernment of the Four Noble Truths. What is dukkha? What is dukkha? Which, by the way, please don't translate as suffering. It's not translated as suffering. Dukkha has too many connotations to be translated as suffering. It is a terrible translation. Dukkha is describing the intrinsic instability of all things. Dukkha is describing that sort of sense, it describes certainly the levels of pain we can experience in this life, but it is describing this intrinsic instability of all things. So discerning what dukkha is, discerning the causes of emotional and psychological distress, discerning where they arise from, holding clearly in one's vision the possibility of the end of all psychological and emotional distress, the cessation, the blowing out of distress, and clearly knowing the way to that end of psychological and emotional distress. Now, insight is something that not only permeates the paramis, but the whole of this path of awakening, to discover for ourselves the penetrating understanding, the liberating understanding, born of seeing all phenomena as they actually are. Now, what the Buddha saw is the way in which ignorance and delusion can permeate so many of our perceptions, our intentions, our thoughts, and our choices. How do we know that is so? Because we end up despairing, fearing, resisting, struggling. All of this is born of not understanding what is. How do we do that? Well, how do we enact ignorance? You know, this is a very curious thing because, you know, the Buddha talks about ignorance as being this sort of like below the radar misunderstanding that leaks out. And it leaks out in our actions, in our reactions, seeking permanence in that which is constantly changing. Seeking satisfaction in that which is intrinsically unable to provide satisfaction. And seeing an independent self-existence where there is not one to be found. This is basically the cause of the problem. So the purpose of insight, if we might say the purpose of insight, is to remove the veils of distortion. And each moment that happens, that moment is liberated. That moment is liberated from suffering. again, we need to turn this into a verb rather than thinking of nibbana, you know, or liberation, or some destination we don't know where. We need to turn that into a verb. How are we nibbana-ing? How are we nibbana-ing? Insight or panya is essentially cultivation of wise view. The wise view of understanding anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self, and the alignment, more importantly, the alignment of our hearts, minds, and lives with that wise view. Now, it's interesting to me, and I think it's no accident, that when in the texts, you know, in the suttas, anicca, impermanence, is always listed as the first insight. In fact, the Buddha once said that there, just as there is no footprint in the animal world larger than the elephant's, there is no insight more important than the direct experiential understanding of impermanence. Because what is previously seen as solid is seen as process. That is what is so important, is seen as process. So rather than this perception of this static world phenomena where things just happen, we start to see process. And this teaching is totally process-oriented. Because when everything is flat, there's no possibility of change. When everything is process, there's endless possibilities of change. What we see is that this whole momentum of process, that nothing lies outside of it. Not our bodies, not our experiences, none of the events we encounter, not our minds, not anything in the world that can be seen or touched or tasted. Nothing lies outside of process. Not a single thing. Everything is in a state of flux. So, what is the implications of that? What is the implications of that? That you're not going to find refuge in something that is essentially always going to move and change and not stay the same. What's the implication? That you cannot rely on it. This is what is dukkha. You cannot rely upon that which is unstable or unreliable for refuge. And they are not self. The Buddha listed these three insights as being the primary insights that lead to the abandonment of craving, the end of aversion and doubt, and to live in the light of non-self, which is to live in the light of non-grasping, non-clinging. These are central. You know, it's very easy to intellectually agree, much harder to actually live in alignment with those core realities, which we actually need to not accept as ideologies, but to actually investigate in our own experience. Where are we aligned? Where is there alignment? Where is there non-alignment? So as I mentioned, you know, earlier on today when I talked about my allergy to the word workshop, there are steps of insight, and the first of them, as I mentioned, is to hear the teaching and to have an intellectual agreement with it. This teaching is meant to be questioned. It is not meant to be accepted. It's not meant to be a creed or a statement of ideology. It is meant to be scrutinized and to be questioned. If something is true, it can withstand all investigation. And it is only through that investigation that we bring, that we take ourselves out of doubt. And doubt certainly is one of the biggest plagues in this path. Experiential insight. Cultivating the calmness, the investigation, we take the teachings into our own minds, bodies, and lives, and start to see for ourselves, moment to moment, how is suffering caused? How is suffering ended? This is what the path is. We cultivate inwardly generated happiness and peace. It changes our relationship to the world. You know, it is one of the reasons why, for example, you know, deeper states of, say, meditative absorptions are cultivated. Some of you will be familiar with them. Because some of those deeper states of meditative absorptions actually result in such depths of happiness, of joy, of peace. There's the deep inner knowing there is nothing in the world that can be gained, that can be accumulated, that are going to generate that level of peace and happiness. And that changes our relationship to the world. It lessens, you know, if we really taste that inwardly generated happiness and peace for ourselves, you know, it changes. I mean, the tendency to identify, the tendency to be lost in craving is so lessened. It's so lessened. Because actually, we're not fooled anymore. We see the notions of self arising and passing like bubbles on a stream. And we know it's an optical illusion, the idea of self. I find this really fascinating. It's an optical illusion. You know, it's the metaphor that I use is kind of, you know, when you watch the sunrise and the sunset, doesn't it look like the sun is rising over there and it's setting over there and it's actually going around the world? I mean, that's what it looks like, doesn't it? Like where the world is standing still, the sun comes up over there, goes down over there. It looks perfectly logical on one level that the sun is going around the earth. Anybody think that's true? We know it's not true. We know it's an optical illusion. But think about how we apply that metaphor to ourselves, that life somehow is revolving around me. The world is revolving around, orbiting around me, and somehow everything changes except me. Everything's unstable except me. Isn't that interesting? The third step of insight, the first to hear the teachings, the second to explore them experientially, and the third step of insight is to embody what we understand. None of these are easy. None of these are easy, but the third is perhaps the most challenging of all. To embody what we know to be true. How do we live in the light of what we understand to be true? How do we embody kindness? How do we practice freedom? Think of that. How do we practice freedom? Rather than, again, you know, nouning this, verbing this, how do we practice freedom? Without the embodiment, sadly, these are good ideas that leave us untouched. I really don't change our lives. Now, I think many people have certain kind of romantic ideas about insight. You know, the sort of feeling that if I sit in the cushion long enough, you know, I'm going to have a moment. I'm going to have a moment that comes with bells and smells and headlines, you know, and get up and say, oh, there was a really important insight. But sometimes this happens. Very, very small percentage of the time. If you look at the discourses, you know, you do see these stories of sudden awakening. But mostly you hear more stories of the very patient cultivation of the paramis. The patient cultivation of the paramis and the quiet falling away of delusion. As so many people, I mean, you know, that I hear this so often in practice, people say, well, you know, I did that, sat for a week, I don't think I had any insights. And I say, well, actually, you know, when I went home, I didn't shout at my mother-in-law. You know why that was? You know, or somehow I have less argument about meeting the difficult or the challenging, things fall away. Now, there are dimensions of insight, and I think it's important to acknowledge these dimensions. And one dimension certainly is the dimension of personal insight. Our story. The story of our life, about who we are, about our relationships. When you sit on a cushion, who do you meet? You know, not your neighbor. Well, sometimes, but mostly you meet yourself. You meet yourself. And there's no shortcuts. There's no shortcuts. I don't think anybody bypasses themselves on the way to enlightenment. We need to know what it means to make peace with and understand our story. Because this is the story we live in. This is the story that we see the world through. Our past arises in the present, and our future is formulated in the present. And we are asked to learn to be mindful and to listen with care. And what happens when we do that? Well, we start to see the places where we get hooked. We start to see the ways that we push things away. We start to see where clinging arises, and of course we see our view of self. Now, I've found in some Dharma circles that there's a certain attitude of dismissiveness towards this dimension of insight. In fact, I've heard people say, well, you know, I just need to let go of my story. I don't know if you've ever been told that or told that to yourself. I just need to let go of my story. As I mentioned earlier, the story will calm. The story will lighten. The story will become more spacious in the light of compassion and calmness and investigation. In reality, certainly what I see, that our personal story is actually where we learn many of the paramis. It's actually where we learn many of the paramis, the transforming lessons of patience, of tolerance, of generosity, of kindness, of calmness. It's where we learn about non-identification, about process and conditions. Does anybody have any questions about this? And I would like to mention that these dimensions of insight are not linear. It's not like you need to make peace with your story and then you move on to the next, you know, you graduate to secondary school and then university. You know, they're not linear. The second dimension of insight, I would say, is the universal story. And it's not, as I mentioned, it's not as if we have to transcend our personal story before we begin to understand the universal story of the three characteristics of change, of dukkha, of non-self. This is our universal story. Those three characteristics, this universal story, begins to be clear to us in our personal story as it begins to slow down. And this is the job of mindfulness, is to slow down the narrative, is to calm the agitation, so we begin to see in our personal story this more universal story. Now, these insights into the three characteristics are said to be liberating insights because they release us from the contracted story of self. The third dimension of insight is, I mean, I don't really like this word, but it is used, is the transcendent story. It's almost a transcendent story, transcendent insight. The very deep understanding of emptiness. Atisha, one of the great teachers of the past, he said, of all the teachings The ultimate is the teaching of emptiness, of which compassion is the very essence. The realization of the truth of emptiness, the nature of reality, is like a very powerful medicine that cures all disease. If you realize emptiness, you become free from clinging. As you feel no craving or grasping, you always have transcendent generosity. Being free from grasping, the unwholesome finds no foothold. Without any concept of self and other, there is no ill will, and there is transcendent patience. Your mind made truly joyful by the realization of emptiness, you always have transcendent diligence. Being free from distraction, which comes from grasping at things as solid, you always have transcendent concentration. Not conceptualizing anything in terms of subject and object, you always have transcendent insight. Okay. Any questions about insight? Yeah.
You know, the term emptiness has always sounded kind of cold and lonely to me. And yet, when I go deep inside, the best times I tend to find a sense of light and warmth. And so, did you say anything about that?
I think, again, emptiness is another term that gets surrounded with a lot of mythology. It's interesting, in the Theravadin tradition, you will hear much more stress upon anatta, non-self. If you go into the Mahayana tradition, you will hear much more stress, very little mention of non-self. You will actually hear much more mention of emptiness. Now, these two are not disconnected, because non-self, we're not talking about annihilation here. We're not talking about nihilism. We are talking about there is no independent self-existence. Very important. The whole thing lies in this one consonant N. It is not no self. It is non-self. And there's a world of difference between those two. So when we think of non-self, it is mean there is no independent self-existence inwardly. Okay, so this is something we check out in our own experience, because it's always I am, I need, I want. We always see our selfing of the moment being shaped by what is identified with. We have a million formations of selfing in a single day. Happy self, calm self, sad self, agitated self. Always being shaped by what is being identified with. So we see there is no abiding self-existence within that. There's no self that stands outside of process. What emptiness is simply widening the implications of that. That there is no thing in the world that has an independent self-existence. So it's actually simply widening that circle, that non-self is as true of this bench, this bell, this chair, that clock, this carpet, the person beside me, as it is of me. That there is no abiding self-existence in anything at all. That's really simply what emptiness is referring to. It's not referring to a vacuum, you know, a blank space. In fact, anything but. Emptiness, the understanding of non-self, the understanding of emptiness is actually beginning to see that the only thing that keeps anything in this world fixed in place is our view of it. That applies to the bench, it applies to me, it applies to my neighbor. That the only thing that keeps anything fixed in place is our view of it. When we take away our view or look underneath our view, because it's not about having no language, you know, it's not about having conventional vocabulary. But when we take away our view, what we see is this flow, this mandala of ever-changing process and conditions coming together in different shapes, different forms, never staying still, never static, but something deeply alive and almost, ungraspable. Ungraspable. To live in harmony with that is to step out of that whole world of seeing this, that, and the other separate and distinct, but made separate and distinct and estranged simply by our view. Actually, when the Buddha talked about understanding non-self, he often talked about it initially by beginning with an external investigation. Because, you know, the example that many of you will be familiar with would be the example of the chariot. You know, well, you know, we don't have, you know, if you take away, you know, is the wheel the chariot? You know, is the wood the chariot? You know, is the seat the chariot? No, you put all this together and we have a conventional view of what is a chariot. But it's more than a conventional view, because once we have a view, attached to our view becomes all the preferences. When we see our view of the distinctness as being reality, there arises all our preferences, our likings, our dislikings. You know, it's a great chariot, it's a terrible chariot, I need a better chariot. You know, it's my chariot, you know, it's your chariot. And all of that just simply builds upon the foundation of the view of independent self-existence. So the Buddha often encouraged the contemplation of non-self, beginning with an external contemplation, and then said, take that and apply that to yourself. So, you know, if we took a chair and we took away, you know, is the seat the chair? Is the metal the chair? Is the color the chair? Of course we would say none of this is the chair. You know, and if we look deeply underneath that view, of course, what we see in this chair is a whole history of conditions that goes back long before we can ever trace, you know, from the people who mined the metals, you know, to the person who had the idea of a chair. Isn't that mean? You know, we see this whole history of conditions, and we know actually this chair is not stuck still. It has a whole future of conditions of change. And we know that there is no independent self-existence in the chair. And what the Buddha says is, take that external reflection and apply it to yourself. And to see how exactly the same applies to you. I have a name, I have a body, I have a mind, I have certain experiences, you know, certain narratives, certain stories. But all of these come together to make who I am. And the who I am is only slightly modified by what is clung to in the moment. So he said, take that, apply that same reflection to yourself. That is the understanding, the liberation through emptiness. And actually the Buddha said, of all of the understandings, liberation through the understanding of emptiness is actually the most liberating of all, the most unshakable of all. So, you know, again, it's just a mythology that surrounds emptiness. But it, as I mentioned, you know, certainly in the early canon, the early texts, you hear the word shunyata mentioned again and again, emptiness. You hear it just as much in Mahayana texts. What you don't hear so much is the term anatta. Because even the term anatta, there can be a slight inclination to think, well, this applies to me and not apply to all things. But in applying to all things, of course, what we see is that we are actually part of this mandala of ever-changing conditions and process, and we never stood outside of it. So there is something, I think, quite important about this word, shunyata, or emptiness, again, is again not the best translation. But to have the correct translation, we need about 10 lines. You know, I mean, it's a problem with Pali. We need about 10 English sentences to translate often a single word.
I have a question. But carrying on from that, I feel that for me it's intellectual doing that, but I can see there's a non-self, and then I can see it's me who can see there's a non-self. There's me can see the self is sometimes happy. Me can sometimes see the self is unhappy or other negative things. That seems constant to me.
Okay.
And that's what I can't...
Unpack?
You know, it will happen in time,
okay.
But right now I can't do anything.
No. It's a good point to raise because I think it's often a question that comes up, you know, who sees all of this, you know. I mean, first of all, it's not at all to dismiss that intellectual knowing.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's very important, and there's many ways in that intellectual knowing really starts to sink and really starts to lessen the identification, for example, with experience as being me or mine. Now, there's two dimensions of selfing. Okay.
Only two.
Only two. The first dimension is the one that is most immediately discernible. It is personality view. It is the personality view that is formed when there is identification with body, feeling, perception, tendencies, and consciousness. So that's where we see it most discernible. You know, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm my body, I'm suffering, you know, I'm my thoughts, you know. So that's the most discernible realm of selfing. That actually becomes very, very clear to us in practice. You know, we see the way that selfing of the moment or the personality view of the moment is shaped by the identification with these five areas that form who I am. Now, that area of clinging is the letting go of that, the actual penetrating, really penetrating understanding to see through that, that it's really relinquished is actually what is called stream entry, part of what is called stream entry. The first kind of, we might say, real stage of real unshakable understanding. But that's a process. There's path and there's fruition. You know, so we see that again and again and again and again until we start to really know it. You know, that this is how the selfing of the personality view, the selfing of the moment, is formed through the identification with these five domains. So that's one domain of selfing. The other one's much more sneaky. And it is mano. It is the conceit of self. That is the conceit of self is exactly as you're describing, that sitting there somehow is this idea in the background of my mind. I see all of this change. I see all of this process. I see all this formation, and I see it. It's the pilot in the cockpit self. You know, what we call the observer, the witness, you know. I'm awareness. Gets even that subtle. You know, I'm not this, but I'm awareness. It's really the sneaky domain of self. It's the one where we feel, although we see that there's not much continuity between personality view, you know, like the happy self doesn't look like the sad self, you know, and the angry self doesn't look like the kind self. We can see the lack of continuity in that. In mano, there's much more of a sense of a continuum. Everything changes but me. Now, but this kind of background self. Now, you know what? I won't worry about that too much. Because it is actually, in certainly classical Buddhist maps of awakening, it's one of the last to go. It's one of the last to go. So I actually wouldn't give that, I actually wouldn't worry about it too much, you know. Because it's like it's not an issue till we make it an issue.
Okay.
you know, then we make it an issue, either through saying this shouldn't be there, or this must be the real me. Well, actually, that's just clinging, you know. So make clinging the object of consciousness. Even make that scent, background sense, the object of mindfulness. You know? But I certainly wouldn't make it into a problem, because it's almost as if that very last kind of embedded sense of I, me, is something that is actually liberated by this sort of development and fruition of insight.
Okay. That then relies a certain amount of faith, that mano is...
Well, I think we can see the distinction between... Oh, that it will disappear?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not criticizing.
No,
that.
No.
It sounds like...
well, you know, just put it into the realm of I don't know.
Yeah.
Put it into the I don't know file.
Okay.
You know, because we don't know.
That's
you know,
right.
I mean, according to everything all of the stories, all the accounts, all the narratives, which I believe there is some truth in them, people describing their whole journey of awakening, mano disappears.
Okay.
But down the road, but I would just say file it in the don't know section. You know, because there's quite really immediately quite enough on our plate to actually... you know, and if we think of this as ripening, let's talk about liberating the moment. Let's talk about liberating the moment from suffering. Let's talk about liberating the moment from clinging. Let's talk about the cultivation of the qualities of heart and mind that really bring, have the capacity to bring such joy, such happiness. This is in the no file. I mean, K-N-O-W file. You know, this is in that file. Let's bring that forward, you know, and see actually how much that sense of mano is present. This is very interesting. How much that mano is present when the kind of wholesome and the skillful and the paramis are really shining.
Thank you.
Probably much less. So again, I wouldn't even think of the liberation of mano as necessarily being this last obstacle, you know, that we're going to, the last demon we're going to grapple with. Actually, I think it's really disempowered by the paramis.
Okay.